Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. As any responsible human with a dog or cat or both knows, and my wife Kate and I have enjoyed both and loved both, visits to the vet, planned or not, are essential to the animal's health. My guest today has treated plenty of dogs and some very large cats in her capacity as a veterinarian. Dr. Joanne Camper earned her undergraduate degree in 1996 from Gustavus and her DVM in 2001 from the University of Minnesota. She practices at the Andover Animal Hospital in Andover, Minnesota, and has treated big cats, think lions and tigers, at the Wildcat Sanctuary in Sandstone, Minnesota. As someone who has occasionally been riveted by the reality TV show Yukon Vet and spent a fair amount of time and money in vet offices over the years, I've been looking forward to speaking with Dr. Camper to learn more about her own journey and work as a vet. So, Dr. Camper, Joanne, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you. This is, I don't know, is this a work day for you or you have the day off?
I have the day off today.
Oh, good.
I work part-time at Andover Animal Hospital, as you said, and part-time at the Wildcat Sanctuary in Sandstone, Minnesota.
How far apart are those two places? I'm trying to think about the geography.
Oh, gosh, about 100 miles or so.
Okay, not terrible, but not exactly close. So we'll get into that work in a bit, obviously, but why don't we start? Actually, I like to start with the pandemic. I know you're a dog cat doctor primarily. First of all, just what has the pandemic done to vets and vet practices?
It has made us extremely busy. A lot of people got pets while they were in quarantine.
Yes, that's
as a project. So right. we never slowed down. We got very busy and continue to be very busy, which leads to a lot of wait times for people. Emergency clinics are having to churn people away often. Yeah. It's really increased business quite a bit.
So that's it. That's kind of a parallel with what's going on with human animals, I guess. I hadn't thought about that, the increase in the business. I've read about the number of people who've, you know, adopted pets for better or worse. I'm not sure. And then what about COVID itself? I mean, I've read now and then that some animals can get it. Is that true? Have you seen any cases of that?
It is true. More so in the non-pet populations.
Okay.
So large cats can get it. Non-human primates can get it. There's been some other cases. Surprisingly, we don't see it in domestic cat or dog populations.
Okay.
That's not to say it's not there, but we're not seeing any positive cases.
Okay. So I guess your busyness comes not from that, but just from sort of what animals require or pets require when people get them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess, but, you know, look, good for business. There's a silver lining. We'll come back to that practice later, your Andover practice in the Wildcat Sanctuary work. Why don't we start with your background, which I like to do in the podcast. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up. I mean, I know, for example, you should stipulate you're the niece of historian James McPherson,
yes,
one of my heroes and with whom I podcasted. And your spouse is Dave Camper, another Gustavus graduate with whom I have podcasted, and had the pleasure of teaching at least, I think, in one course. But tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
I actually grew up just outside St. Peter, Minnesota, where Gustavus is located. That's where my family lives. So I grew up, went to St. Peter High School and then on to Gustavus.
Was Gustavus sort of inevitable, do you think, given the family history and the proximity? Or
I'm not sure it was inevitable, but there was a lot going for it. My parents both graduated from Gustavus.
Oh, I didn't know both. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Several of my aunts and uncles have graduated from Gustavus. Mm-hmm. both my siblings graduated from Gustavus.
That's amazing.
And my after school slash summer job was working at the food service at Gustavus when I was in high school.
That's, I would say that's pretty close to inevitable.
Yeah. We also had a great secondary program where in my high school, you could take classes at Gustavus, which then you also got college credit, which I participated in.
Yeah, that's a, I don't know if others, maybe other states do that, I imagine, but that's a great program. I love that. I've had a couple of high school students in class and it's just been great. I really enjoyed that. What were you taking when you were doing that as a high school student? Do you remember?
I took some language classes like French and German. And I also took a geology course just for fun.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I took it for fun or I had to take it. I loved the one geology course I took as an undergraduate at Northern Illinois University. I just loved. I wonder who was that? Was that, who would that have been, geology? Jim Welch, maybe? I'm trying to think who would have been there when you were. You don't remember the prof, do you?
To be honest, I don't. Yeah, that's okay. It was long enough ago.
Right. Yeah, the whole department has changed from when you were there, even from just in the last few years. Well, I'm glad you went to Gustavus. Did you take any history courses? It's okay if you didn't. I'm just curious.
I took a course called Minnesota History.
Oh.
And J-term for my freshman year.
Yeah, so let's think 92. About that. That wasn't Donovan Lund. No, he was retired.
It was
Donovan.
Yeah, he came back out of retirement.
Yes. Okay, yeah, that may be. Right. My wife, Kate Wittenstein, and I mean, he's irreplaceable, was, and now passed away. But we were, once Donovan retired, then we were hired on a joint contract. And yeah, he was certainly the expert in the department in Minnesota history. Boy, I've often thought I should revive that course somehow, but that's another story. Maybe something on animals, pets in Minnesota history. There we go. There's a whole subfield of pet history now, which I haven't read.
Oh, really?
Sounds interesting. It honestly looks really good, really interesting. Like good, serious historians writing about the history of pets or dogs, whatever. Anyway, so that's interesting. So were you already in love with animals as a young kid, dogs, cats?
Yeah, I was. We had a hobby farm. So we didn't have a lot of animals, but we had cows and horses at one point. We had a lot of chickens and ducks and geese and cats and dogs.
Wow. What kind of dogs?
Golden retrievers, mostly.
Oh, they're sweet. Our dog was a black lab, Sam, and our cat was like a tuxedo cat.
Nice.
The cat we got from the vet the pound in St. Peter's, a great cat named Cooper. That's neat. My mom grew up on a farm, but by the time my brother and I were going there to visit, the animals were pretty much gone, which always kind of bummed me out. You know, it was soybeans and corn and
there
were some chickens. That's interesting. So that a hobby farm means what your parents were both. Well, your mom, I think, worked for the biology department. Is that right?
She did. Yeah. They were both biology teachers initially.
Okay.
And then my father branched out into some other things. My mom continued to teach biology and then came to work at the biology department at Gustavus.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Then, I mean, you weren't inevitably meant to be a vet, but on the other hand, growing up with animals and two parents who are biologists, were you involved in like caring for the animals as a kid? I mean, doing some of that work?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. I remember many mornings getting up to go bottle feed calves. Collecting eggs. But my parents also exposed us to biology in a lot of other ways. It's very common when we were out and about or even just outside at home, they would identify birds and, you know, tell us what they were, plants, things like that. So we were exposed to biology in a lot of little ways all the time.
That's neat.
Which kind of led to a knowledge base that was very helpful.
Yeah. So it sounds like you have siblings, brothers and sisters.
Yes, I have an older sister, Lori Biederman, who graduated from Gustavus in 95. And she is a kind of ecology botany instructor at University of Ames, Iowa.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's great.
And I have a younger brother who's 7 years younger than I am. And I don't remember which year he graduated. That would involve doing some math, but he's actually a canine officer.
Oh, wow.
With Niqua County.
Oh my gosh. So I just added them to my, after we finish recording more on them both for potential podcasts down the road. That's great.
Yeah.
Very cool. So by the time you come to Gustavus, are you thinking of being a vet? Is that already on the horizon for you? Or
That was always my goal. Even when I was quite young, that was my vision of myself growing up.
And did that come from, were you reading about vets or watching shows or movies as well as caring for the animals on the farm?
Oh, yes. I was an avid reader and read a lot of books kind of relating to animals, all the James Herriot books.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you watch the shows too on PBS?
I have seen some since then.
Yes, yeah. Since then. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't recall ever thinking I'd like to be a vet as a kid, but the more I sometimes say to students, you know, geez, I think maybe I would have enjoyed it, you know, but that's from a distance, not knowing all the work involved. Because I love dogs and cats both. So what was your major at Gustavus? Was it biology?
It was biology, and I minored in music.
Oh, fantastic. What, playing or singing or both?
Both. Singing primarily. I was in the Gustavus Choir, and I also took harp lessons just to kind of do something different.
Wow. Was that, wait a second, was that Ann Pesavento? Who did the harp? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember either. Gosh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, I think it might have been Anne. That's really cool. I the harp. Mostly I know the harp from Groucho Marx movies and Harpo, who's some. But, oh, it's so beautiful. That's neat. So do you still play?
Oh, gosh, no.
No. Yeah, I'm sure you don't have the time. Well, you could, play some harp for the animals. I don't know. that's another interesting topic we can talk about, music and animals. So you major in biology. Do you have fond or not so fond memories of your experience at Gustavus?
Oh, very fond. Yeah. It was definitely one of my favorite eras to look back on. Gustavus Choir was an amazing experience, especially when we had Dr. Carl Erickson as a conductor. Had really wonderful instruction in the biology department.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking, trying to think who'd have been there. Well, John Lammert was there.
John Lammert.
Bob Bellig was probably there. Oh, Bill Heikamp, right?
Oh, yep.
What about, was Colleen Jacks? She was there too, I think, maybe.
She came kind of towards the end, I believe, of my time there.
And Professor Jacks, who I think is retired, she was an alum also and came out of the University of Chicago for her PhD. Yeah, it's just a very, I mean, as you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, Gustavus is just so strong. Well, strong in so many areas, but certainly strong in the sciences and biology. Biology department is still going really, really strong, Pam Kittleson and others. that's cool. So, as a biology major, and you're thinking of vet school, are there particular courses you have to take to get ready for vet school, or just sort of is it just major in biology? I mean, is it like pre-med sort of?
I imagine it's similar to pre-med. There's, you know, biology, biochemistry. Chemistry, lots, calculus, kind of a wide range of things.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, were you doing any work with animals as an undergraduate aside from the farm? I mean, like, were you involved in, I can't remember what it was called, Pound Pals or something or anything like that?
No, there weren't really any programs at that time.
Yeah.
I was really involved in a lot of other experiences at Gustavus. I'm not sure I would have
right
taking the time, you know, trying to be well-rounded, I guess.
Yeah, but. Well, no, I mean, first of all, the demanding, were you a double major or just the bio major?
Just the bio major.
And I don't mean just as in, you know, only the one major was enough. Yeah, that's a demanding major. And then with the co-curricular, right, sometimes students get too busy, do too much, but I can understand what you're saying. So by the time you start applying for vet school when your senior year, is that how it works?
Most of the time people do. I took a year off.
Oh, you did? Oh, what'd
yeah,
you
do just then? To earn a little money before going.
You're working just anything or?
I actually worked at my father's company.
Oh, okay.
So he started a company that created a product called refuse derived fuel. Well, not that he created the concept of it, but they made refuse derived fuel, which is fuel made from garbage, essentially, which has a lot of side shoots like recycling and composting and things like that. So I did work for him during that year.
That's cool. Is that based in St. Peter or where?
St. Peter and Mankato, North Mankato.
I need to podcast with your dad too.
Oh yeah, it's really interesting.
That's interesting. Fuel? When you say fuel, do you mean is it fuel for like engines or
fuel for electricity? So there are several power plants in Minnesota that burn refuse derived fuel. So the one in Mankato does. There's one in Rochester, one in St. Paul. I don't remember where all of them are.
That's very cool.
Yeah, they're adapted to burn.
That's neat. So, and then you said one sibling is kind of an ecology prof. I mean, so maybe, boy, a lot of stuff runs in the family. That's neat.
Yeah.
Did you choose to, I mean, my sense, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it's one of the, just it's a top vet school in the country. Is that your first choice?
Yeah, absolutely. For many reasons. First of all, I enjoy being in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's significantly easier to get into a vet school if you are a resident of that state.
Sure.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah, cheaper. Yeah. What are some of the other top vet schools in the country? I actually don't know. Would it be like Iowa or?
Iowa has been in the past. I'm not sure where they rank right now. Okay. UC Davis is another one that's.
Oh, really? Huh. Mm-hmm. Great history department there.
Yeah,
that's neat. So
there's quite a few, and they're all good. I suppose it depends on what you measure.
Yeah.
Top.
Okay. Well, so you got in. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Sometimes I'm talking to people and they don't really seem to understand that you are a doctor, right? That a vet is a doctor,
right?
And you know, honestly, I mean, the training is rigorous. I'm always interested in people's work and how they get there. I'm not sure why. Maybe that's why I became a labor historian. But anyway, tell us a little bit about the training, what it's like, the process of going to vet school.
Well, it's much more challenging to get into vet school than med school.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, there's just a lot fewer schools.
Oh, sure.
You have to, you're competing against a greater pool of applicants. Training school is for 4 years. That's after graduating from undergrad, of course.
Yeah, right.
And there's basically 3 years of lectures and labs and things like that, including some work with patients. And then the senior year is entirely working with patients in different departments. And following that, you can do internships and residencies as well to become a specialist.
And did you do that, the internship? I was curious about that.
I did not. I thought I really wanted to be a mixed animal practitioner. Okay. So that's the route I went. The trouble with internships and residencies is they're virtually unpaid.
Oh, so,
especially internships, and it's kind of the stereotypical what you think internships when you think of doctors. It's many, many, many hours per day, per week. No sleep, no pay. It's rough. And residencies are not a whole lot better. But really, residencies are going to be more if you want to specialize in, say, like surgery or cardiology, ophthalmology, which I did. That's not the path I wanted to take.
Yeah. You remind me, we did see for our I don't know if you've ever come across Dr. Fran Smith, who is a lab person, lab breeder. We found Sam and just fell in love with Sam. It's a little, I can't remember, she's 8 months old or 8 weeks, whatever it would have been, but she's awesome vet. But then Sam unexpectedly developed eye trouble, and we were sent to a vet ophthalmologist. And, you know, never even occurred to me that there was such a person, but of course there was. Can't remember his name. And the simple test he did was he shut out the lights. And yes, Sam couldn't see. You know, he definitely had some vision issues. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, there are all these specialties. Is that residency different? I'm sure if you're in human med school, you're paid or not for a residency? I don't know.
I believe they're paid, and veterinary residents are paid as well, but okay. not
the internships.
Fabulously.
Yeah.
And the debt load coming out of vet school is
significant, I'm sure. Yeah.
Very significant. Yeah. We're talking like right now students are graduating with debt around $250,000.
Oh my God. Holy yeah. cow.
Jeez. If you include their undergrad, it's very expensive.
Holy cow.
And so then you enter a field where, pay is relatively low compared to other doctors.
Right. Yeah, we'll hear about that.
You know, starting a salary averages about 80,000,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's nothing with that debt. I mean, I shouldn't say nothing.
Yeah, it's that debt that is just crippling. You know, a lot of students graduating from vet school today will never pay off their student debt. You know, they're going to be paying that.
That's terrible. Well,
it is.
That's awful. Wow. Because obviously, from among other things, that can discourage people who would be terrific vets from going, you know.
It does. And it does create a diversity challenge, too.
Yes. Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's a good point, too. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I'm thinking some women vets, but all quote unquote white in my experience. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
There are more female vets than male vets.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah. When I was in school, so I graduated in 2001 and there were 92 in my graduating class and 10 of those 92 were men.
Wow. My gosh. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's predominantly female now.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you have any idea what explains that?
Oh, yeah, it's the salaries.
It's the salaries. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. The so that's another fallout of the salaries. Were there other Gustavus in your Gustavus alums in your class, your graduating class?
There were, which was impressive, I felt, for 92, a class of 92.
Yeah.
There were three of us.
That's awesome.
So that's a high percentage.
That's amazing. You know, I keep thinking that, I don't know if they've done, but the quarterly, the alumni magazine ought to do something on doctor, you know, just health. I mean, there's so many Gusties go to the U for, you know, for the MD. And then I've run into one other, a couple of vets or vets in training who were Gustavus graduates. I remember we took Sam lived to be about 16, I think, and had a really good long. Yeah, he was just the greatest dog in the world. I mean, I know everyone says that about their child and their dog or whatever. But at one point later in his life, you know, he was having trouble. I don't know if it was arthritis or whatever it was, but we went to a wonderful place. I think it was in Bloomington. I'm blanking on the name, where they, you know, worked on rehabbing animals. I remember even a donkey with prosthetic legs we saw there once. But but a young man there, I started talking to him, and sure enough, he was a Gustavus graduate who was maybe doing one of these internships or shadowing at that place. I'm blanking on his name. But yeah, anyway, that's cool. That's a lot. I mean, in graduating class. Yeah, it's impressive. So once you, when you say you're working with patients while you're in training, are you doing, my brother-in-law is a neurosurgeon, and my wife, Kate, he's married to my wife, Kate's sister. Kate remembers going into the dissecting room with David and kind of seeing all these bodies, you know. Is that the same thing in vet school? Are you working on dead animals to learn about anatomy and that sort of thing?
Freshman year. Okay. Yeah. We do a lot of anatomy with cadavers.
Okay. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Cadavers. And are these cadavers just, I mean, are they donated by people whose pets have died, or are they just strays, or how does it work? Do you know?
I believe, I honestly don't know.
Yeah. That's okay.
And I know they weren't like random animals they picked up on the street.
Yeah.
And that's
reassuring.
I didn't really ask.
Yeah, it's okay.
Because I probably didn't want to know.
Yeah.
But I can say with confidence, like, they're not animals that came in to the hospital there, the teaching hospital, and then were put to sleep or died or whatever, that were supposed to be cremated or buried and instead went to the labs. That did not happen.
Got it. Yeah, that's good. That's reassuring.
Senior year, we basically work in the teaching hospital along with the qualified veterinarians, and that includes taking care of patients after they've passed. So I can guarantee that doesn't happen.
Yeah, but that's good to know. Yeah. I just assumed that was the case. Yeah. Do you have any memories of what it was like? I'm sure you do, of doing that first work on a dog. I imagine you hadn't done that as a bio undergraduate.
No.
What was that like?
It's uncomfortable at first. It's disconcerting. But it's approached in a respectful way, which is helpful. So you start with working on one area or one thing, and so that's the area you're focused on, not seeing everything just kind of blah right there in front of you.
Right. And then you stay with that same cadaver the whole time?
The whole semester, and then the next semester it's a different animal. So I think we had dogs the first semester, first quarter, and we had cows and horses and things like that too.
Wow. That would be interesting. Gosh. So by the time you graduate, are you already set in terms of where you're going to go for, were you headed to the Andover practice already, or you graduate and have to kind of figure out, where am I going? You apply. How does that work?
Yeah. So most people start applying for jobs in the spring of their senior year. I applied to a few places and ended up working in Mora, Minnesota as a mixed animal practitioner. So doing kind of a little bit of everything, dogs and cats, goats, sheep, rabbit, horses, cows.
Holy cow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Which I really enjoyed the aspect of working with all those different types of animals. But I ended up kind of channeling into small animal because kind of two reasons narrowed it down. So there's just so much to know about each species.
Yes. I was just thinking, my goodness, when you mentioned all those animals. Yeah.
I mean, veterinarians are very much like MDs, but for a different species.
Right.
And as a general practitioner, you kind of have to know, pretty in depth about a lot of things like ophthalmology, cardiology, radiology, just because, there are specialists, but they're not as readily available, or they're not something an owner may choose to pursue. Sure. I finally decided I could either be pretty good at dealing with all the different species, or I could be better at a few. And I thought that was more important. And with large animals, much as I enjoyed working with those animals, there's a lot of times a large animal that ends up kind of directing a rodeo more than practicing medicine.
image.
and it's dangerous. It's dangerous work. And
oh, I imagine. I've wondered about that. Yeah. We spoke about horses and cows. And
Yeah, it can be very dangerous work. Yeah. So I narrowed down to small animal.
Well, you know, when you're doing, let's say, horses or cow, are you going to the site, the farm, whatever it is, or are they coming to you, or a mix of both?
Mix of both.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I've wondered what that would be like with, partly because when we saw this mule, you know, we were all these dogs and cats, and suddenly there's a mule with, I think, two prosthetic legs coming off a, you know, what do they call it? Like not a carp, you know, whatever you hitch to your trailer. Thank you. Yeah. Good Lord. It was amazing. Well, I think you made the right decision. It sounds like. Do you have yourself? You have dogs and cats now?
We have cats.
Cats. How many?
We have 5 right now.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. And do they go out? What is the story with cats? I mean, we didn't let our cat go out. Is that, I mean, do your cats go out? What do you think is the vet about that?
It's so much safer for cats to be inside only. Okay. So they're much less risk of predators, of human predators, of diseases and injury and being hit by cars. It's cats should be inside 100%, with the exception of like a catio or screened in porch.
Yeah, that's right. We had the screened in porch, and Cooper would just go, he'd sit on the top of a, you know, chair, wicker chair, the top part of the chair, just the back of the chair, and just watch the animal life, whatever the heck he saw. He did escape once, and we found him in the next door neighbor's garage.
That's a common finding place. Because okay.
Yeah. I have no idea
they get
how
out there, then they're terrified. So
that's what that's exactly right. He was terrified. I remember mm-hmm. just deciding to open, you know, the neighbor's garage door, and there was Cooper like looking terrified.
Yeah.
thank goodness we found him. I always felt kind of funny. I felt like he in a way I felt bad, like he wanted to be outside, but you know, thinking what you're thinking, it wasn't good for him, wasn't good for birds, you know, so he didn't. And I think he was, you know, it must have been hard for him to see the dog always going out. Sam would, you know, just go outside the porch door and everything. I don't know.
I don't know that they necessarily think that way.
Yeah, maybe I'm projecting. We did try walking him, and actually in our condo building here in downtown Minneapolis, there's a young couple who are regularly walking their cat with a harness. I don't know how common that is. It did not work well with Cooper. He didn't take well to it.
I think it's great if it works, but yeah, very few cats are going to participate in that.
Yeah, that's what it was so much fun having both. They were so different and they got along. I mean, like we had, you know, the crate for Sam, and it was always open, never. And he would go in there. Sometimes Cooper would be in there first and they'd sleep together in there. Sometimes they'd sleep together on the bed. It was cool to see that. So, all right, let's talk a little bit about your practice. Thanks for all that information. Yeah. It's so interesting to me how people train and what they wind up doing. What's the Andover practice like? So it sounds like it's fairly big. Tell us a little bit about that place.
Yeah, well, it was originally started by a classmate of mine from vet school.
Okay.
And it grew from a single doctor practice, which was just her and a technician, to now where we have 8 doctors and a whole lot of technicians and receptionists. We've been very successful at growing and having a lot of clients and kind of clients and their pets join our family, essentially.
Nice. Yeah. How many, is it a practice that specializes primarily in smaller animals or the whole range?
We are small animal and particularly dogs and cats.
Okay.
So we don't see a lot of rabbits and snakes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm just asking
about
snakes.
From time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's funny. I wondered about, and gosh, so do vets, I mean, vets, the stuff vets have to know. I mean, honestly, when you think about all the different species, right?
Yeah, it's a lot.
It's much harder than, I think it's much harder than being a human animal doctor. I mean, you got one, there's sort of one basic human body, right? I mean, different varieties, I guess, in terms of age and weight and height, but goodness gracious, a snake is, I would think a snake is very different from a cat. I don't know.
It is.
Yeah.
And a bird is very different. And
yeah. I mean, birds, hamsters, cows, sheep, it's amazing. So when you're touching on something I wanted to talk about when you mentioned your practice has been successful and growing, and that's the business side of being a vet, because it is a business, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to make money. You've got overhead and all that stuff. How involved are you in that in your practice? I mean, do you have sort of meetings? Are there, you know, partners? How does that side of it work, the business side?
Each clinic is very different in how they approach that. Okay. At our clinic, we don't have a lot of input in that. I mean, we certainly have input as to what, like, medications we stock or anesthesia protocols that we may choose to use. But as far as the business side of it, we don't really. And that's okay by me. We don't really get business training in vet school. That's something that's really lacking. But
right,
yeah,
because it is a business, and you think, you know, I mean, this classmate who started it. So is it like a collective ownership, or how does it work? Is it the one person who began it? Is the quote unquote owner?
She was the sole owner until just this spring. Actually sold to a corporation, which is
okay,
becoming very common in our profession.
Yeah, that was the next question I had for you. I've noticed that even with I went to Twin Cities Orthopedics recently, and they something called iHealth or something like that, or One Health. Yeah. So that is common among vets too. It makes sense, I guess, given just what's going on in medicine. Then what about does your practice recommend pet insurance? We went back and forth on that and didn't get it. I kind of wish we did.
That's a field that is still figuring out what it is.
Yeah.
We don't spend a lot of time recommending it, but we don't discourage it.
Okay.
It's one of those things, because pre-existing conditions are generally not covered by pet insurance.
Right.
So it's kind of like either you get it when they're young,
yes,
and don't have any issues, and if your pet does have issues, it does turn out to be a great investment. But if you don't get it when they're young, or you get it when they're young and they don't really ever have health issues, then you may not feel it's as good an investment, but you can't really know ahead of time.
Right, exactly. You can't tell. But the reason we didn't get it is exactly what you just said. Our pets were well along at that point, and it was just mentioned, right, as a possibility. We didn't.
Yeah.
The vet wasn't pushing it. And I'm just remembering our vet, Dr. Barkhuizen. He also pursued a law degree, and he was interested in, I don't know if it was malpractice issues, but whatever. You know, he was also. I think he became a lawyer with an emphasis on whatever it would have been, you know, stuff, legal issues that vets would deal with.
Sure.
It's so interesting to me because, medicine is, it's a business, right? When you go to these doctor's offices and the overhead and the paperwork and all of that.
Mm-hmm. That and stuff. The drugs are very expensive. And
yes.
All sorts of things.
Yeah. Is this corporation, so do they own strictly veterinary practices? Do you know?
They do.
Okay. Yeah, that's neat. So let's talk a little bit about the animals. I don't know. What do you think about the word pets? Sometimes that word bothers me. I don't know why, but that's
what it is. Why does it bother you?
I don't know. It feels like, why does that? Yeah, it's a good question. Why does it bother you? Somehow it feels like I'm being not condescending, but I'm sort of, you know, and you'd like the word owner too. That has always bothered me. But somehow pet doesn't quite adequately describe how I and my wife felt about Sam and Cooper, right? They're not children, but they seem like more than pets. I don't know.
They're family members.
They're family. That's exactly what I was just going to say. Precisely right. Yeah. Anyway, pets.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I just don't know that there's another option that adequately covers it.
No, I don't know. I mean, I use the word, you know, need. I think the place we went to was called Pet Crossing Animal Hospital. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny, though, how, you know, language shapes can shape how we view things, including the animals. And we forget that we human beings are animals, too. That's the other thing that drives me crazy. Right. But in any case, what do you have a typical day at Andover? Is there such a thing?
Well, typically I work from 8 to 6 and see patients potentially every 20 minutes. We have our appointment blocks kind of set every 20 minutes, but that varies. If there's, if I'm scheduled to do a surgery, or right now, a lot of times when I am at work, I am doing urgent care. So that's part of how we've tried to cope with the overwhelming demand that's happening right now is sometimes having a doctor that all they do is urgent care. So patients that don't have an appointment scheduled but calling because their pet is sick or have an emergency. And then that's who I see. And so that varies time-wise because you can't always schedule when an emergency is.
That must be kind of intense, no? Or
it can be. It can be.
I mean, do you find yourself at least? I imagine on occasion where it's a life and death situation.
I mean, yes, of course, that happens.
Yeah. That's. I mean, I don't know. It's a huge. Well, with any, like, same with a human doctor, it's a huge responsibility. What are some of the? So, a typical day. Are you? Let's say if you're in urgent care, is there any kind of pattern to what's presenting, what the patients are presenting or not?
Not really. It can be anything from like an ear infection to I would say a lot of what we see is gastrointestinal. So vomiting, bleeding, that kind of thing. For the past several weeks, pretty much every week I'm doing at least one foreign body removal surgery. We seem to have a run on that.
I was going to ask you about the surgery. So, to do surgery, you didn't have to specialize. I mean, are all vets able to do that kind of surgery? I don't know.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. We were lucky that never happened to Sam, but yeah, that was always something we were. Well, you see rocks, you see gravel outside our. You know, we had like the, what is it called? The guard landscaping gravel. That's for some reason he was. I don't know if it was salt or what it was. Like, Sam, what are you doing? You know, but unfortunately, never had to go to the vet for that. Wow. So it must. I mean, I suppose the variety is. I guess maybe it doesn't get boring, or does it? At times it get routine.
That's a good question. I think any profession, there's going to be times when you feel kind of a little bit repetitive.
Yes,
certain times of certain times of year, some problems are more of an issue, like allergy season and stuff like that.
Yeah. So,
but there's a lot of variety too.
Yeah. What do you have a favorite kind of? Animal, or I mean, a breed. Let's say you're working with dogs, or you're ecumenical. They're all wonderful.
I would say I'm fairly ecumenical. Yeah, there's some breeds that I of dog that I am more cautious about, but that's not because of the breed of the dog. It's more just my personal experiences.
My wife, Kate, has always wanted a Saint Bernard. And so when I was courting her, so to speak, I got her a fake Saint Bernard. That was as close as, because I had dog sat for Saint Bernard once. And oh my God, sweet, but just not exactly a house pet.
No.
Yeah. The one thing I've been reading about lately, I don't know why, there've been some articles. And I mean, I knew this, but just to read more about it, is the she also loves bulldogs. But I'm always telling her, you know, those poor dogs. They, correct me if I'm wrong, they have a lot of breathing problems, because weren't they bred that way to have that face sort of smashed in?
Is this a trend right now to breed them kind of as deformed as possible? And it's a terrible life for those dogs.
Yeah, that's awful. God, just awful.
Because, you know, it's good for business. Don't get me wrong. Right. They're a pretty big money pit for owners, though.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, well, I've said that to her too. Yeah, all the different issues. Yeah, that, I mean, the poor dog, I, God, yeah. Oh. So, because they would have a snout, right? Normally, I mean, they wouldn't look that way.
Right. And these dogs with the flatter faces, it's called brachiocephalic breeds. Okay. They have all the same equipment and the same surface area, say, as a collie. Yeah. Or, you know, but it's all squashed together. And so that leads to a lot of problems.
Yeah, that's awful. I hope that stops. That's just horrible. Yeah. It's a problem because you say, oh, they look so cute. But yeah, they're kind of suffering, really, I think.
They are. Yeah. Many times they are. Oh, yeah. That's awful.
So how did you get involved? So you're doing your vet work at Andover. And then how did you get involved with the Wildcat Sanctuary? And why don't you tell us a little bit about that place as well? I've never been there. I'd like to go now.
Well, the Wildcat Sanctuary is a place for wildcats that cannot be released back into their home environments. Unfortunately, there is a large population of exotic animals owned by people, and they should not be, but they are. And then those animals eventually become ill or old or not useful anymore to whoever owns them. And then kind of what do you do with them? So we provide a sanctuary for wild cats. And unfortunately, they can't be returned to their homes.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, that's so weird to me. So these are, I was wondering, they don't come from zoos, in other words. These are mostly or exclusively, I guess, pets at some point or whatever.
Primarily. Wow. Now, we do have some lions that came from a zoo in Argentina. So Argentina, a few years ago, shut down all of their zoos. Wow. They don't have zoos anymore, but they had all these animals that had no place to go. So for I think a few years they still had these animals in these zoos that people weren't attending anymore, and eventually had to find places outside of their country for them to go.
Is the Wildcat Sanctuary part of a larger, I mean, are there other sites, other wildcat sanctuaries, I'm imagining, around the country? Or
there are. They're not partners or things like that, but they are part of a larger association of sanctuaries. Okay. You know, they have to meet certain requirements. You can't just say, hey, I have a sanctuary.
Yeah, I can't just open one up in my right, backyard or whatever.
Although people do.
Yes,
people
taking the words out of my mouth, I've read these. Yes, that's another nightmare.
So the exotic pet trade, which includes buying things like tiger cubs and things like that, is one of the largest organized crime kind of things. So it's a $30 billion a year kind of thing. It's one of the top illegal money sources.
That's mine. I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah. So speaking just of tigers, there are probably, they believe around 10,000 tigers in the United States alone that are not associated with accredited zoos or sanctuaries. So these are in people's backyards. These are, in roadside zoos. And these animals are often not getting the care that they should get. They're not getting veterinary care, and they're used as props for things. You know, people get excited about wanting to pet baby tigers and things like that, which I understand. It would be exciting.
Yeah.
The reality, though, is like they have these cubs, and they're only going to be able to be pet by people for a short amount of time until they're just not.
Right.
You know, they're not going to
become a big tiger.
Right. you know, so we're talking a matter of like a month or two. Wow. And so they have to keep producing more and more cubs to continue the cub petting kind of thing. God, that's horrible. And so then what do you do with all the cubs that have aged out of that?
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not I mean, I did not know about that trade, just how big it is. You know, wasn't there some show, a TV show about some guy with a tiger?
There's Tiger King.
Yes. Is that the sort of thing that's about? Or I haven't seen it.
I mean, yes, definitely part of it.
Okay.
That whole story is kind of a wild ride in general. but yeah, that's part of what is happening. Okay. You have these places that claim to be sanctuaries, but they're really more like roadside zoos, and which is a term, I mean, just by like, they're not following regulations. Right. They're not necessarily behaving humanely towards. Sure.
Yeah. World. I mean, I could have a bunch of cubs or something, and then, you know, they get bigger and open up. No, I mean, that's a whole nother, it's awful. Well, thank God for the wildcat sanctuary. What is it like to go there and work there? I mean, you're working on lions, tigers. I mean, I don't know, whatever else you've got, leopards.
Yeah. We have, leopards. We have a lot of pumas and or cougars and bobcats, both from the exotic pet trade, from the fur trade, and wild born. You know, people mean really well, and if they find like we have several that were found as kittens, like bobcat kittens that people thought were abandoned, and so they took them in because they wanted to care for them and protect them, but then they get to a size where they're not something you keep in your home anymore. Right. And now they have no ability to take care of themselves in the wild, so they can't be re-released.
So where are the animals kept? Are they sort of outdoor places for them, or how does it work at the sanctuary?
All of the cats have enclosures that include both heated indoor facilities and outside facilities. So they can choose where they want to be, and there's space for their, you know, in their enclosures. They have room to roam around. They've got they get a lot of enrichment, so they get toys and they get other enrichment. If you go on their Facebook page, they often post when they have interesting enrichment things for the cats.
Does that include music? We were talking about that before we started recording it.
It really doesn't.
I was just curious because I've done stuff about music and medicine, human people, you know, human beings, and what music can do.
Yeah.
You know, are they able to be together at all, any of them, or is it solitary for each animal?
Some of them are together with their family groups or with other individuals. Others are solitary. It really depends on that individual animal's preference. Yeah.
So when you're working, let's say have you done surgery on some of these, I'm imagining?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What is it? I mean, this may be a dumb question, but is it essentially the same as a domestic cat? It's the same anatomy, more or less? Or?
It is. It's just a lot bigger.
A lot bigger, yeah.
And that includes a lot bigger blood vessels and things like that. And there's challenges with, you know, the larger a patient is, the more anesthesia can be challenging to protect their lungs and other things like that.
Yeah. Wow. That must be so amazing to see. I mean, I've just seen the pictures online to be with the animal and caring for it like that. That's incredible. And to me, that's sacred work. I think I'm not a vegetarian, but I should, I'm a guilty meat eater, but it just bothers me so much how animals are treated. When I eat meat, I try to source it from a quote unquote, you know, humanely raised and humanely slaughtered, whatever the hell that means. But in any case, you know, we were talking before we started recording about the whole question of animal rights. There's this, I know just a little bit about it, a case involving an elephant, the Bronx Zoo, named, maybe ironically named Happy, who I think is now 50, at least was at the Bronx Zoo. And there's a court case. Again, I only know, I've read just very little about this, but a court case, I think it may still be in progress, where people on behalf of the elephant are arguing that the elephant is being held illegally in the United States because the elephant is a person. Now, I'm wondering, when you work with animals, as you do, do you come to see them differently? I mean, do you come to see them as, I mean, they have personalities, they have rights. I don't know how much you've thought about any of that. And I'm just asking, it's perfectly fine if you haven't, obviously.
Well, I mean, certainly in animals all have their each have their own individuality, their own personality. And so that's definitely important. And I do feel like they have rights to, you know, kind treatment and not being exploited. I think that talking about their rights in a legal sense is where it becomes much trickier.
Right. Yes.
Because that's then who's deciding what's better or worse for them? So, right. For instance, in the case of Happy, like, what are the alternatives besides being at the zoo? So going to an elephant sanctuary, does that fulfill those? Is there any space anywhere at an elephant sanctuary?
Yeah. You know, those are important. Right. And that's just going to go to someone's backyard, obviously.
Yeah. And sometimes it's trying to find the least of the evils. So again, with Happy, maybe even a sanctuary. I mean, that's still not as good as being in the wild.
Right.
But if Happy can't go back to the wild, what do you do?
Yeah, no, those are all interesting questions, important questions. And as you say, challenging questions. It is amazing to me. And again, I mean, I sometimes say to myself, who are you to talk? You eat animals, but it is amazing to me the levels of cruelty, intentional or not, neglect, whatever it is. They certainly have a right to a healthy, caring existence, ideally where they should be, you know, not locked up in a zoo. You know, which reminds me, when you said that about Argentina, do you have any idea why they, was it because of, they just felt the animals were being mistreated in zoos? They closed all their zoos? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I am honestly not sure. My impression is that it was kind of due to social thinking that zoos are not appropriate places.
Okay.
But
yeah, that's interesting. I'm going
to
look.
That's not to say I agree with the fact that
right.
zoos are inappropriate places. Right. Or, I mean, there's no black and white, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I grew up with in Chicago. I mean, we went to the Brookfield Zoo all the time and loved it. The Lincoln Park Zoo. I still go to zoos occasionally. Yeah, that's a whole nother podcast for us, I think, at some point, maybe. Maybe with Happy, too. We'll see. So do you have a favorite kind of big cat?
Well, I like them all in different ways, I would say. Tigers are very engaging. They're very, they're kind of like dogs in that way. They're very kind of people. They interact with people kind of it's hard to describe. So one thing that's interesting, this is kind of a tangent, is that dogs and cats, domesticated dogs and cats, it has been found that they look at people in a different way than they look at other cats and dogs. What I mean is when they look at humans, they look at the eyes on the left side of the face, I believe. I might be wrong with that, but and it's how people look at people. It's about reading body language and facial expression.
Oh, sure. I can see that as someone who had a dog and a cat.
Yeah. But dogs don't communicate with other dogs that way.
Huh.
It's different. And it was thought originally that dogs were the only species that did that, you know, domesticated dogs.
Yes.
But then of course cats do it too. They're just not as easy to study.
Of course, they're cats.
Yeah, but a lot of these larger cats do it too, and I would say tigers especially.
Like that's amazing.
They you know, they look at you in the face, and they're
That must be
more
incredible.
More so than some of the other cats. Yeah.
Yeah, that must be absolutely incredible to experience that up close too. I mean, yeah. You're right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, up close, but also from a distance.
Yeah.
You know, safety is.
Well, yeah, you have to
obviously
be
the number one
sure.
thing. We're never with these cats when they're not completely anesthetized.
Right. Yeah. Well, gosh, I don't know. One day I want to come visit you up there. I mean, I love, if that's possible, I think that would be amazing to see.
Yeah. They do sometimes have open houses and stuff like that. They don't have the, it's not open to the public because
yeah.
they feel that, you know, these cats have already.
Yeah. They've been right bothered.
Right. They're
yeah,
not sure. working anymore.
Exploited enough. Yeah.
And
yeah.
some of these cats have had extremely bad experiences with humans and just don't. You know, it's very stressful for them to have humans around.
It's awful.
But they
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just say they do. They do definitely have opportunities periodically.
I'm gonna add that to my long list. The more people I speak with, the more things I want. My so-called bucket list gets longer and longer. So I speak with people for the podcast, doing all these interesting things. What is the average lifespan for a large cat?
In the wild, it's probably more like 12-ish to 15. Okay. In captivity, they can live well into their 20s.
Wow.
Many of them, especially like the tigers and the lions.
Yeah.
It's servals, so, I mean, that kind of thing, probably closer to 18.
Okay. It's just increasingly amazing to me the way we think of it. Well, this is the historian, right? But people, how our understandings of pets, of animals have changed over time. I mean, once upon a time, you wouldn't think anything of, you know, I don't know, chaining a dog, and I'm sure some people still do it, or leaving it in its locked crate. I mean, just, you know, that has all changed, thank goodness. But understanding, you know, I know there's the danger of anthropomorphizing, but just understanding that they're not people, but they're not just things, right? They're not just
right,
objects.
They're individuals.
Yeah, that's, yes, thank you. And you're helping me, that question you asked earlier, which is such a good question, why does the word pet bother me? I think that's why it feels like I'm objectifying them in some kind of weird way. But anyway, wow, I could keep going. You're doing awesome work as we wind down here, and interesting work. And by the way, do you watch vet shows, or you get enough on the job as it is?
I don't watch them. Like you said, I probably get enough on the job, but there's also some popular vet shows that really misrepresent appropriate
I was
veterinary
gonna ask you
care.
About that, I'm sure. Yeah. I don't know about this UConn vet. I do watch that occasionally, not a lot, but yeah.
But then also things like Tiger King, et cetera. I find it too upsetting.
Yes.
And also knowing a little more of the real story behind it, you know, makes it even more aggravating.
Sure. So. Yeah. No, there's some famous movie about orca whale at,
Caribbean
SeaWorld, which I have not been able to bring myself to watch.
Yeah,
I get too, I don't know if you can't, you graduated in, 96. Nadine Lisiak, she's a bio, she works with whales. So anyway, was a bio and history double major at Gustavus, but she's, you know, told me, you know, watch that documentary. And I want to, but yet I know how upset I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Just so horrible. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. As we wind down, I want to give you a chance to make your pitch for your alma mater. Why Gustavus?
That's hard to answer in just a few sentences. It was such a wonderful experience for me. I mean, the friends that I developed are still my friends now. Had really good experiences meeting all sorts of different people. You know, even if they're not people that ended up being friends or lifelong friends, like,
right.
You know, I felt like I've got an extremely good education, not just with book learning, but also with people and interacting and just kind of the lifestyle. I would say, you know, it was a very good experience, and you know, going to a university after that was also a fine experience, but it's not the same as the community at Gustavus.
No, and it's a
generally safe community too. So you can feel, you can kind of spread your wings.
I guess. That's exactly right. Oh, I love that. I think that's true. I think, and I try to encourage students, I talk about, I might start using your phrase, spread your wings. Yeah, I think, I mean, that's really ideally what you do in college. And yeah, you feel able, safe to do that, encouraged to do it. I think that's really important. I talk about, you know, being open to opportunities. But, you know, so all well said. Thank you so much for your time. Hope maybe I'll see you at the wildlife sanctuary one day when it's open, you know, when they have one of these public events. You know, just as someone who thinks about animals, thank you for taking good care of them. So have a good day, your day, quote unquote, off. And thanks again.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.